This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a STEAM experience for middle school students at Hearst Castle.
We brought 50 kids. These are 12, 13-year-old kids, an hour and a half away, approximately. And out of those 50 kids, only 15 of them had ever seen the ocean.
And we'll learn about olive oil production on the Central Coast.
We had this great crop, we thought. We had all these blooms on the trees. And then we had 5 minutes of hail. And that was the end of that.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 30th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Here at KCBX, we hope you're staying healthy and feeling well. As the pandemic continues, we're going to keep bringing you a mix of timely Central Coast stories and interviews with interesting local people. We hope that you find the hour to be entertaining, thoughtful, and also just to provide some good companionship as you continue to shelter at home. As the novel coronavirus pandemic widens, the acute shortage of personal protective equipment worsens. Things like face masks and hand sanitizer. To help meet the great need, Central Coast distilleries are changing their production lines from booze to bottling ethanol-based sanitizer. KCBX's Greta Mart has more.
For years, Aaron Berg has been making spirits.
Rums, gins, liqueurs, whiskey, brandy, a little bit of everything.
Berg now runs the Cowwise Spirits Company in Paso Robles.
Our flagship spirit is our Big Sur gin that we make from grapes and native plants that grow in Big Sur.
But the pandemic has changed all that. Berg says he started hearing about a shortage of hand sanitizer and figured while it may be sold out at local stores, hospitals and first responders must have a steady supply.
These people who I assumed had access to this stuff do not, and they're scrambling looking for it so that they can continue to serve the community and take care of people. So within a matter of 12 hours, I started producing hand sanitizer and getting it out to people.
He got the recipe and guidelines from the federal agency that regulates distilleries.
For the first time ever, as far as I know, the FDA and the federal government has given distilleries emergency authority to make hand sanitizer, which is crazy. I never thought I would ever see something like that.
Berg's phones are ringing almost nonstop these days, people looking to buy his sanitizer. For the time being, he has enough of the necessary ingredients, high-proof alcohol, hydrogen peroxide, glycerin. Even getting his hands on those proved challenging until he reached out to the local business community and got what he needed. A CBD oil producer had extra bottles. A Paso Robles flavor extract producer had extra hydrogen peroxide. And he didn't need to change any of his stills.
I already have the equipment needed. I have the stainless steel sanitary tanks and the pumps and everything needed to make this stuff. And so the transition was a very easy one for me.
All U.S. distilleries have permission to manufacture hand sanitizer through at least June 30th. So far, Berg's made about 200 gallons. Joe Barton, co-owner of Crowbar Craft Distillery, Paso Robles, started making sanitizer to use at his own retail store when crowds descended before the stay-at-home orders. Speaking inside his distillery, he says the wider need for sanitizer by hospitals, public safety, grocery stores quickly became apparent.
For us, it's been almost mind-blowing to see how there isn't a whole lot there. And it won't just be us. Every distillery needs to try to help because there's such a lack that not one person here can fill it.
Liking it to how 9/11 changed air travel forever, Barton says the coronavirus pandemic has changed his outlook.
This period of time is probably going to be life-changing for all of us. I think there'll be a lot of things that we do in life that won't ever be the same because of this experience.
Barton estimates he's bottled and sold a few hundred gallons of sanitizer so far, and he plans to continue making it until the pandemic wanes. Then he'll return to producing gin, vodka, and brandy. As for Cowwise's Aaron Berg, he says he hopes this pandemic will open eyes to the necessity of pre-planning.
I think the most surprising and shocking thing to me that will always stay with me is how how everyone is just out of stock, how people that you would not expect to be out of stock of something as essential as sanitizer are out of it now. And it's not their fault. It's our supply chain has just broken down in the face of this pandemic that we've never experienced before. And I think that'll always leave a lasting impression on me that, you know, hospitals don't have the sanitizer. They're having to use trash bags as hospital gowns. And to me, that's just crazy and something I never thought I'd see and hope that I never have to see again.
With KCBX News, I'm Greta Mart.
While tours at Hearst Castle have been suspended due to the pandemic, the foundation at Hearst Castle is planning for the future. We'll learn about how the organization inspires middle school students through Hearst Castle State Park STEAM experiences, focusing on science, technology, engineering, the arts, and mathematics.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Hearst Castle. We're with Michael Young, who's executive director of the Hearst Castle Foundation. Hi, Michael.
Good to see you, and thank you for making the drive. And actually, I have to correct you, it is a new name. It's the Foundation at Hearst Castle.
Oh, interesting. So this is all brand new.
Hey, this is all brand new. It's actually an organization that's been around for 35 years. But what we've been able to do is really kind of expand our mission. And once we expanded our mission, we also wanted to rebrand. And the old name, which I was on the board almost 18 years ago, for a number of years, it was the Friends of Hearst Castle. And we have all decided, just given the expansion of our mission and the broadening of our reach, we really felt like the name needed to line up with our organization, something with more gravitas. Hearst Castle is an international brand, and what we're doing now with the foundation is really more of a national scope.
Paradoxically, it's a state parks organization, so it's state and yet national and worldwide.
It's really unique. I mean, it's one of the most unique state parks, I think, anywhere. And so I think the new name, the new branding, and our expanded mission really do help. And so, yes, the foundation at Hearst Castle is now open for business, and we're very pleased with how far we've come in the last 2 years.
Why was it formed, and what's its primary mission?
Primary mission is to make sure that we continue to generate donations and bring in funding to help with many of the projects that the state doesn't have a budget to do.
There are two levels in your world, in conservancy and restoration.
Mm-hmm. Conservancy is like what we're doing with some of the alabaster.
Or the tapestries,
mm-hmm. Yes. And so it's just making sure that what we have doesn't degrade or doesn't get to a point where then it has to be restoration. I think it's pretty straightforward. Things that are okay, we just make sure that they remain in that. And you think about all of the thousands of artifacts. And you're talking, too, about the tile floors that everybody walks on throughout the gardens. Those have to continuously be maintained or they'll just disintegrate.
It's incredible the number of bodies that troop through Hearst Castle every day.
Yeah, and people forget, you know, you get up there and you're in awe of how one man and woman, Julia Morgan, could create such an amazing place, and you think of it as a home. But the reality is Hearst Castle is one of the finest fine art museums in our country, and it holds some incredible artifacts and pieces of art. That's why it is what it is. But you sometimes forget, and you're literally walking on wonderful antiques and wonderful artifacts. And so the floors are something that has to be preserved as well.
You've been here 18 years plus,
yeah,
and yet it still is mind-blowing, fascinating for you.
It really is, and my history is really unique, but I was asked almost 20 years ago to be part of a task force that Governor Gray Davis put together. Rusty Arreaz, who was the old state parks, head of state parks, asked to put together a group of eclectic people from all different types of businesses to come together to figure out how to rebrand and to monetize and to remarket Hearst Castle, to let people, not just in this area, but all over the world know, and to be able to provide an experience for them that would be memorable. Our new mission and our expanded mission is what we're doing, and which I am so excited about, is that we are bringing underserved junior high kids from all over the state of California.
You help with the funding for the school buses and whatnot to make that happen?
We pay for everything.
Wow.
We have a tour that is second to none. Our mission is to bring 1,000 kids each year from all over the state, everywhere from Richmond to far away as Orange County, and then a lot of in between. And we take care of the local schools as well. But I'll give you a good example. King City is an hour and a half away. This is from an underserved junior high, and we brought 50 kids plus teachers and chaperones. These are 12, 13-year-old kids, an hour and a half away, approximately. And out of those 50 kids, only 15 of them had ever seen the ocean.
Wow.
And so it's really our STEAM program. And if you go to our website, which is foundation@hurstcastle.com, you can see many of the videos that we have of these school visits. But basically they come, and again, many of them, you know, hardly any of them have ever been to the castle. I would say 99% of them have never been to the castle.
Did not even know about it.
And didn't even know it existed because they're 12 and 13 years old. And they're coming from backgrounds that the family doesn't, at dinner, doesn't talk about Hearst Castle. And many of them are from families that are laborers. Their one day off is Sunday, and they're not going to spend it traveling all around the state or the country. They're just trying to recover from a very hard week.
Have you observed some pretty incredible aha moments with these kids?
It's unbelievable. And so basically when they get here, the first thing they do is they go in and they watch the movie Building the Dream on the IMAX theater. And they've never seen anything like that. So that's the first thing that they do when they get off the bus. And then they drive up the hill. And I've been on a number of the buses with them. And to me, the bus ride up the hill, you're looking out, you're seeing zebras. You're seeing all this different wildlife. And the kids, it was like a Disney ride, just the bus trip alone, which I've been on that road too many times and I find it boring. Well, through a kid's eyes.
That's your commute, isn't it?
That's my commute. But through a kid's eyes, they might as well be in a safari. You know, they're going up and they're getting, I mean, that is a very steep, very windy road. So they get up to the top of the mountain, and really our program is about STEAM. So it's science, technology, engineering, art, and math. And there's no better place in the world to show firsthand and in real life how STEAM is used to do things like building a castle and engineering that road. And then we also talk about...
That really is. I'm thinking about it. STEAM is like home base for Hearst Castle because of the addition of art.
And you think about technology. When Hearst was here... He ran his entire operation from the top of that hill when he was here, and he was here quite a bit. He ran, hundreds of papers and radio stations and movie studios, all from here, because he had the highest forms of technology available anywhere in the world. He had some of the most advanced phones. He had teletype. He had telegraph. You name it. He had it here. And so what's interesting is to be able to show the kids that technology. And then they are able to kind of understand how far we have come. And then the engineering is a no-brainer, just the road itself, engineering what they did to build that castle.
And one thing that blows my mind are the giant live oak trees that he physically moved.
And that's the other thing we talk about. Here's a man that isn't really given the credit for being such a naturalist. He's always been extremely concerned about the land. What's interesting is these kids have an opportunity to really see the evolution of technology. They get to see basically things that are all over the world. So here's kids that have never gone probably more than 10 square miles outside of where they grew up and where they currently live. And now they're having, in 3 hours, having a chance to see things from all over the world. And so you have a chance to really see the world when you visit Hearst Castle. But the one thing that really kind of resonates, especially with the young women, is when we start telling the story about Julia Morgan. And many of the children that we have, many of them are young Latinas, and we really use the Julia Morgan story. There's nobody like her. She broke down every single barrier and opened up a pathway for so many women, and she was incredibly prolific.
Over 100 years ago.
Yeah, and so you talk about engineering, what she did with this building. She was at the forefront of building everything with concrete and rebar. Nobody did that. But she knew she had to do that because of, we weren't sitting very far from a fault, and you're in California. And I'm only touching on a few things that are discussed during these kids' tours, but it really opens their eyes to all things with science, technology, engineering, art, and math. The aha moment, they get off the bus, and we take them up to the very top, right in front of the Casa Grande, and we take them over to a terrace that looks out over the ocean. And literally their jaws just drop. And, kids talk. And when they see that, it's like quiet. They're just like, I can't believe what I'm seeing here. And so after that, after they go through the tours, and the guides are instructed to really look at the castle and take these kids through on these tours with this whole STEAM in mind. So everything is really geared towards that, because we want kids to understand and challenge them on what they are good at in school, right? And how it could apply to one of these curriculums that then turns into a career. And so after that half day, then we bring them down, we feed them, and then we take them across the way to Hearst State Beach, which is one of the most beautiful beaches. And we take them out onto the pier. They teach them about marine biology, and they send them on a scavenger hunt. And then the beautiful thing is we allow them to, you know, put their feet and their hands in the water. And again, another aha moment was one of these young kids, after he put his hands in the water and the, kind of splashed up on him, he's like, "This water is so salty." And I just laughed. I'm like, wow, the things that we take for granted.
Yeah, like you said, many of them have never seen the ocean.
Never seen the ocean, and they're an hour and a half away. So at the end of the day, what we do is we take them on the pier. And at the pier on San Simeon, you're looking at this beautiful cove. You're looking at the warehouses where all the building materials and everything and all the artifacts were brought in and then taken up the hill. And then you look back down the pier, and you're looking up at the castle. And so we ask these kids to reflect and say, you know, how is your view of your world and your dreams changed since coming here this day? And the responses that we get are just mind-blowing, and they make you cry. So you're going to really inspire a couple kids on each trip. So what we're looking to do is establish then, we're going to bring some of these kids back, and we're going to start with some of the young girls. We want to put together what's called the Julia Morgan Empowerment Conference, where we get some of the architecture and engineering students, some of the young women from Cal Poly and from Cal or whatever, because Julie Morgan has so many connections to Cal, and bring them together during this conference and really try to inspire some of these young kids to go forward. And then what we'd love to be able to do is follow some of these kids and end up scholarshipping them. And so there's a very long-term plan. Again, we're in our second year, and because of the donors that we're now getting, again, this all doesn't happen for nothing. We have to raise funds to be able to, one, to bring the kids in, and also the hundreds of thousands of dollars that we need to allocate each year towards restoration and preservation.
Literally cloistered on a mountaintop, far away from even San Luis Obispo, visually, mentally. How do you reach out? How do you engage?
The beauty of today's technology is through social media. We don't have a big budget, and have an engaging website. Those things, we have been able to very quickly take this from what was really a local group. And we really are now at a point where I think we can officially call it a rebirth of an organization.
Michael Young, what a great morning in paradise. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. Appreciate you making the trip.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Hearst Castle.
To learn more about the Foundation's STEAM experiences or to become a member or donor, check their website at foundationhearstcastle.com. California State Parks has closed Hearst San Simeon State Historical Monument. All planned tours have been suspended and refunds given. To hear a longer version of the interview with Michael Young, check our website, kcbx.org. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Up next, contributor Beth Thornton introduces us to a nonprofit organization that helps homeless students stay on track with their schoolwork. Schools on Wheels started many years ago on Skid Row in Los Angeles. They now have tutors working from Riverside to Santa Barbara. We'll hear from the regional coordinator for Santa Barbara County and one of the tutors working here on the Central Coast.
In just a couple of weeks since we recorded this interview, life has changed drastically due to stay-at-home orders during the pandemic. School on Wheels has stopped all in-person tutoring. They are currently in contact with school districts and shelters to arrange distance learning opportunities for homeless students. They report that only 25% of the shelters they work with have Wi-Fi available for residents. And now, here's the interview recorded earlier. This is Beth Thornton. We're talking about School on Wheels. I'm here with two representatives from the organization.
Hey, my name is Chris Walsh, and I am the regional coordinator for School on Wheels for Santa Barbara and Ventura County. So my job is to match volunteer tutors who have been trained with students experiencing homelessness, whether they're living in shelters, foster youth group homes, or unsheltered in motels, campgrounds, vehicles.
My name's Eden Nettinger. I'm a tutor with School on Wheels. I've tutored now for about a year and a half, and I am also a tutor coordinator.
Chris, why don't we start with you? Do you want to tell us a little bit about the history of School on Wheels?
Sure. So School on Wheels founded in 1993. It was a retired educator living in Malibu. Her name was Agnes Stevens, and she worked in this area. She saw a population that was in need. Students were falling farther and farther behind in school because of the uncertainty of their lives living in homelessness. And so she created School on Wheels. It's totally volunteer-based. We are 100% funded through donations. We get no government funding. I think we're in 6 counties. We go as far south as South Orange County, and as you mentioned, all the way out to the Riverside area, and then as far north as Goleta.
How many children in our area are affected by homelessness and need your services?
In Ventura County, Santa Barbara, we served over 300 students last year, but we're just reaching a fraction of the number. They do point-in-time counts. I know in Santa Barbara area, the last point-in-time count had over 1,800 homeless individuals, and that includes children and families. I have at this time about 40 tutors working one-on-one with students in Santa Barbara alone.
Tell us about the challenges that the students are facing. Homeless students face unique challenges in that they're trying to stay up with their schoolwork, but they might be moving around and not in school every day.
Exactly. So students experiencing homelessness are 2 times as likely to score poorly on standardized tests. They're 3 times more likely to be placed in special education programs, and they're 4 times more likely to drop out of school. They also lose a grade level to 3 grade levels every time they are moving to a new area. So our goal is to fill that gap and to be able to help these students get on equal footing with their classmates and be able to work at grade level and excel in school.
I read on your website that homeless youth are 9 times more likely to repeat a grade, but that just 10 weeks of tutoring can bring them back up a whole grade level. Is that so? Talk to us more about that.
Yes. So what we do is we provide brand new backpacks, school supplies for as long as they're in school. We provide assistance in getting school records to the new schools. And I think the most important thing that we do is we give these students who have chaos in their lives, who have transition in their lives, a stable source of someone who cares, who is there simply because they care and they're volunteering to be there to meet with them every single week and to help them with schoolwork, as well as the programs we have, which are literacy programs and academic programs as well.
I know you do the tutoring and you've mentioned supplies.
Yes.
What else?
We partner with other organizations. So we will partner with United Way, Big Brothers Big Sisters. We partner with senior projects in order to network so that if a family is in need of shelter, clothing, those kinds of things, we can direct them.
Tell us how you match a tutor to a student.
All of our tutors are volunteers. They find us through the website, schoolonwheels.org. Really easy to sign up. We train our tutors. There's an orientation video. They attend an in-person training. We do a background check and we do reference checks. Once all of that clears and they finish their training, I look at what works best for them in terms of days, times, locations. I look at my list of students who have been referred to me through shelters, through school districts, word of mouth. We go to motels, do motel outreach to find these families, and then I match the tutor with a student that I think will be a great match because we ask about a year commitment from our tutors.
And the students are K through 12?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Eden, what inspired you to volunteer?
So there are a few issues that are extremely important to me. One of them is education. I believe at the root of many solutions for social issues, it is education. And it's really important to start as young as possible with kids, because those years are incredibly formative. And then the two others are houselessness and hunger, as those are basic rights. So School on Wheels clearly puts those two together. I also love working with kids, so it was right up my alley. My mom knows the founder of School on Wheels, Agnes Stevens, and so it all made sense.
And tell us about the type of training you went through to become a tutor.
As Chris mentions, we do a background check, we watch a video online, and then if we're still interested, we do an in-person training before we tutor. And that's a lot about statistics like Chris listed off in terms of the effects of houselessness on a student in their education, as well as why School on Wheels does the work that they do, why it's so important, why consistency is important, the effect that you can have as a tutor, and also the effect that the student can have on you. So it's really important going into tutoring, knowing your purpose, what you're doing for this kid, and potentially what this kid is doing for you as well.
How often do you meet with the students?
Usually it's once a week for about an hour. I now tutor my student twice a week.
Can you describe a typical session for us?
Depending on the week, sometimes my student will have a big project coming up or is struggling with a specific topic, and so if it seems pressing, I definitely will give attention to that, so it might be math. But I also try my best to not just do homework. School on Wheels really emphasizes that this is not just an organization that helps students do homework. It's to make learning fun, and it's also to learn other skills beyond just math, science, writing. So when I can, when there's not a big project coming up, my student and I, we love to do science projects together. So playing with Oobleck, for example. Sometimes it has nothing to do with school, and it's a life skill. So currently we're making a vision board so we can stay motivated and keep our goals in mind when moving forward.
I imagine homeless youth are under a lot of stress. And do your sessions ever overflow into other areas of, do you find yourself not just talking about math and school projects, but perhaps other things going on in their lives?
Yeah, definitely.
And are you trained to help in that way, or do you have resources for that?
So we offer social-emotional learning workshops and trainings for both the staff and for the tutors. We actually, on our website, have pages of resources for tutors, webinars, online workshops, assessments, and also links to worksheets, online programs as well. So we try to be really cognizant. And in our trainings, both the intro training and the advanced training, we talk about meeting a student where they are, understanding the trauma that they've had. We work in foster youth group homes with youths 12 to 18 who've been human trafficked. So we understand the tutors have to have specialized training to go in there and work with these children, really, who have experienced such trauma in their lives.
Eden, you're a student yourself.
Yeah. I'm a global studies major, so you definitely run into topics about social issues and social justice. I also have a minor in poverty, inequality, and social justice, so they pair together pretty well. Definitely learn the most from doing School on Wheels beyond just taking classes on it. And I will say, to Chris's point, the people that work for School on Wheels are so helpful in connecting you with resources. They get back to you so quickly when you ask them for a question. So sometimes the things that you talk about with your student are beyond what you know or what you understand. And School on Wheels is really helpful in providing you those resources if you do need help with that.
Most of the time you're meeting your student in person, mm-hmm. wherever they happen to be. Mm-hmm. If they leave the area or move to a different place, are you able to stay in touch with them?
So in my experience, it was myself that left the area. I was studying abroad. But like Chris talked about, consistency is incredibly important. And my student said he, instead of switching to a new tutor, wanted to stay with being online. So we would every week have a Google Hangouts. You would have to change your lesson somewhat so it can be done through the computer. Luckily, there are so many resources on the internet that it's pretty easy to do so. And you can screen share. There's a whiteboard app that you can use. So you really can do everything online short of, you know, doing a science experiment, a physical science experiment.
Do the students have access to the technology?
Often, if our students are living in shelters, Transition House, which is our shelter in Santa Barbara, has a family support center with computers, so the students can access there and then with their tutor go on to our website to access our resources. If the students are unsheltered, they can actually write a request for a Chromebook or computer to be awarded to them through School on Wheels so that they have that for their own studies. And I've given out a number of those in my own region.
And how can people get involved, people on the Central Coast, or to access your resources if need be?
Our website is schoolonwheels.org. Go on our website, watch the video, read a little bit about our organization. I keep hearing when I meet people at outreach events, it's the nonprofit that people haven't heard of before. And I'm amazed because we've been around since 1993, but we're continuing to grow and expand. If you're interested in becoming a volunteer and are willing to go through the training and the background check, because we do want to ensure safety and quality with our students, we love getting volunteers. Everything from retired seniors all the way down to 12-year-olds will volunteer to tutor with their parent.
Well, thank you very much. Chris Walsh, Eden Ettinger from School on Wheels.
Oh, thank you.
We talked a lot about volunteers in this conversation, but that was before the need for social distancing. School on Wheels says what's important now is the need to stay connected to students via computers and tablets. Please contact schoolonwheels.org if you can help. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Finally, olive oil. Come along on a journey with Father Ian to learn all about Central Coast olive oil.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Olive oil. It's amazing that the olives and the oil are produced right here on the Central Coast. And let's jump right in and find out how it's been going on for quite some time.
Clotilde Julien, and I'm a co-owner of Mill on Wheels, mobile olive processing plant.
How did olives get to California?
The Franciscan fathers came into South America, and after that they want to colonize the Indians, and they were coming up the coast. First trees that they planted were in San Diego, and then they came up the coast, and as they were making the missions, they were planting olive trees, and that's how the olive trees came into California. They used it to preserve their food. Olive oil is one of the best natural preservatives for food. Anything you keep soaking in olive oil, as long as it's not in contact with air, it's perfectly fine as a preservative. They could preserve meat, the vegetables, everything, and then they just had to cook it, and it was cooked with olive oil, so can't get any better than that. They knew what was good. They made wine, they had olive oil, and they just knew how to... Yes, and made bread, so they had it all. After that, a lot of people realized that they were making good wind barriers for their crops. So if you go out in the valley, or even up in Napa, they planted a lot of them along their crops, like the grapes and everything, because it blocks the wind. And so initially they were doing it as windbreakers, and then they realized that you could use the olives for something. They started making the olives in Lindsay, and that became capital of the table olives. You know, the black olives the kids put on their fingers, that's the Lindsay olives. And so they made a business out of it, which was very smart. Now a lot of it goes into oil.
If you go to the La Purissima mission in Lompoc, you can see an olive oil press from the mission era. There is a photo on the Playing with Food podcast page. My adventure with olive oil started in the spring when the olive trees were just beginning to bud in San Miguel in northern San Luis Obispo County.
Tom Bear, farmer, Solana Farms. These trees are approximately 10-year-old Arbequina varietal. They have been developed into a hedge or a row so that they could be mechanically harvested.
When you plant an olive tree, how long does it take until it produces?
It's going to start producing within the first couple of years. It sometimes is beneficial to actually remove the fruit during the younger years, not to put too much stress on it, and to let it grow into a little bit stronger tree so that it can carry the weight of the fruit. I'd say typically it would be 5 years.
Quite an investment, 5 years to get your first crop that you can make oil into. What can you do with the olives in those first 4 years?
You could always brine the olives. It's still, again, the argument of having that weight hanging on the tree and creating a stress level. You might still be fine removing the olives or even before they become a developed olive to actually take it off.
So we're here in early spring. There's these little tiny, like 1 millimeter little bunches of balls on there. What are those?
That actually is the soon-to-be flower and soon-to-be an olive. And what's going to happen is in the next couple of weeks, the little blossoms are going to form. And in the rows, approximately every 10 to 15 trees, there's a pollinator in here. So when the winds come, it'll carry and pollinate all of the fruit inside this one little block of olives that we have. They are self-pollinating. We don't need bees to actually produce a crop. People do sometimes bring bees in. The three tree varietals that are most common now would be Arbequina, Korniki, which is a Greek varietal, Arbisona. The mix of those three make for good pollinators. If you have Arbequina as a general varietal, then you would use either a Korniki or an Arbisona as a pollinator. And vice versa, out in the other where you have a Korniki block, it'd be Arbisona or Arbequina as a pollinator.
So you need a different varietal to pollinate?
We just do it because it's proven to work. We water quite heavily because of the soil and the salt. I believe in smaller rounds of watering, but many, rather than long watering blocks and fewer. It just seems to keep the tree and the canopy much happier. In managing the vineyard, along with just setting watering times and nutrition times, we are sort of heading into the future with the use of drones and light waves and looking at the actual conditions of the plants, their health, their water needs, their vigor. If it's having a health issue, you can literally walk right to it because it can give you the GPS location and saves a lot of time with the maintenance of it. This is something that is new for farming. Last year, I used a similar program through a provider of fertilizers. They also had a satellite program where they took images of the vineyard and then shared with me the filtered imagery to tell me if I was having watering issues, health issues, and basically just worked in a spectrum of color to work your way through it. You know, in the next 10 years, it's going to really become the most important issue of farming in general. They do it for row crops, potatoes, everything.
Later in May, when the trees were budding along nicely, growers gathered at the celebration of the Olive Oil Awards that kicked off the Paso Robles Olive Oil Festival. They took some time to discuss olive growing.
Karen Talent, The Groves on 41.
Shahana Rahman, Boca Bella Farms.
Scott Lindberg, Mountain Springs Olive Ranch.
Marcy Lindberg, Mountain Springs Olive Ranch.
Jennifer Talent, The Groves on 41.
Karen Roach, Olea Farm.
Rick Roach, Olea Farms.
How many varieties are growing on the Central Coast?
Hundreds of varietals.
A lot of varieties. We just grow Arbequina.
It's the most planted in California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
The Arbequina is actually one of the hardiest.
The hardiness is, especially in this area with the drought, is a drought tolerant, which means it can survive on little water, although that affects your production. And also you can plant them high density so you can machine harvest if that's what you want to do.
What are some of the challenges of getting started in olive growing and olive oil business?
How long a program?
Right. That's a full-size program. When we bought our farm, prior owners told us we had no experience farming, and they said, oh, it's so easy. You water the trees, you harvest, you press them, you make oil. It's the easiest thing. Turns out that none of those things are true, that farming is actually very hard. So one example is the first year we had this great crop, we thought. We had all these blooms on the trees. We're going to have lots of fruit. And then we had 5 minutes of hail. And that was the end of that. So weather, Mother Nature can be very fickle. So I think that has been one of the hardest things, that and the drought.
Where are you located?
San Miguel. We had 5 minutes of hail. We thought, this is so cool. Look at the hail. You know, it's like 2 minutes. And then we're going, oh my God, it's knocking all the blooms off the trees. So it's one example of how take all this time to you're nurturing your trees, you're watering, you're fertilizing, you're watching them grow. And then just in a few minutes, it could totally change the landscape of what your projection is.
So we're all pretty close to a full bloom here now in our trees. And so as long as there's no winds and no rain, And no hail.
And no hail.
Yes, and no freeze. Yes. We're going to do great.
We need rain.
Well, but not right now.
A little bit of light rain.
Fickle Mother Nature is only one of the challenges for growers, and among the other challengers is the fickle consumer.
What are the joys and challenges of marketing and selling your vinyl product?
Oh, it's easy. It's easy. We're competing with $4 imposter product in the grocery store. Yeah, trying to sell for $20.
It's what we're doing, like with the Olive Festival, we're educating the public.
Right.
And in California especially, I think people are conditioned to think that Italian olive oil is the best olive oil or Greek olive oil, and not understanding how there are different types of oil and the import process and the certification process is not the same. California has been really good to us, I think, especially with a very stringent certification process, so that when we're certified as extra virgin, it means there's a process and standards that go with that. I think we're all, especially in the Olive Growers Association, committed to try to go out there and educate the public about what it means to have certified California extra virgin olive oil.
Then it was harvest time in November up at Olea Farms in Templeton, run by Karen and Rick Roach.
Here with Karen in the Grove, and it's harvest time.
It's harvest time, best time of the year. This orchard here at Olea is 1,200 Arbequina trees, all one variety. When we pick these trees, we like to get a mixture of green, a little bit of blush. And when I say blush, we'll look at some of the olives. You'll see that they're starting to turn a little bit of purple on the bottom. And then we have some really nice purple ones. So I like to get a combination of that. Usually a third, and a third is ideal for us. So the ripeness is a big factor in the flavor profile. Arbequina is always green and grassy with a little peppery finish on the back. And you can play with that a little bit by leaving the fruit on the tree longer or taking it off when it's not ripe. The sooner the fruit comes off the tree, the more robust and peppery and green grassy flavor you'll have. And the longer the fruit stays on, the more it mellows it out. So it'll just be a little bit more of a mild green grassy herbaceous front with still a slight pepperiness. So that's how we can play a little bit. Arbequina has its flavor profile. You can't change that. It is a varietal, but you can play a little bit with the spectrum of the notes.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Father Ian is learning all about olives and olive oil produced on the Central Coast. Let's get back to the conversation.
How long does it take to harvest 1,200 trees?
1,200 trees takes us about a day and a half of a crew of 50.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And do you get out there yourself?
I do. I was actually out here with the rake for about an hour, and then it made me even appreciate more what these crews do. An hour, I was done. It was like, okay, back to the computer I go. It's strenuous. It's a lot of work, raking and hand harvesting. You know, a lot of the fields now are being put in all mechanical harvest now. So there's a huge cost factor and also labor force. Right now, the crews are in and they're raking the trees. This orchard here is all hand harvest. So how they're doing it is they lay down tarp in order to catch any of the fruit that would be falling off the trees. Once they get the tarps laid down, they grab their rakes and they grab each branch and they just rake down. Sometimes they'll use gloves and hands to strip them. As you can see, the gentleman is raking off any of the leaves and the branches. And then they take it and they put it in the bin, and the bin goes directly to the mill. So yes, you'll see that there are some left. The first year that we had the ranch, I just had to come out here and pick them all. Second year, not so much, and today's the third year, and it's like, it hurts me. It sounds funny to see fruit left on the trees, you know, but they can't get it all. Even mechanical harvesters.
I mean, they're small.
They're small, but yeah. These trees were loaded this year. So if you see some of the trees that are loaded, you'll see that they have gotten 95% of it.
Husband Rick described another way of harvesting.
Typically, the larger producers, what they do is they mechanically harvest. There's several different harvesters that they can use. One is very much like the grapes harvesters that you see. They drive right over the top of the trees. They shake the fruit off the tree. They also use almond shakers, cherry shakers. If you're a big producer, that's the way you want to do it. Typically, $600 an acre to mechanically harvest compared to $3,000 to $3,500 to have it hand harvested.
Big difference.
Then it was time to turn the olives into oil.
We're here in a parking lot in Templeton with this big truck and a lot of noise and people just hanging around with buckets of olives. So what's going on?
Today is small load day for milling for all the small farmers here in this area. Mill on Wheels is doing the milling, so it's the world's largest mobile mill that's producing the olive oil for these smaller growers and farmers here in this area. It's a great service. They're able to come down here and get their olives produced into olive oil today at a very reasonable price. And this is a huge turnout this year for olives. Last year, because of the weather that we had, the trees weren't sure what to do, so they didn't produce any oil, if at all, in this area. This year, the trees are loaded. It's a really good crop to be had. So it's a really good year for California extra virgin olive oil. And that's what the mobile mill here produces, nothing but extra virgin olive oil. It's the first cold press that produces the extra virgin.
I see people literally with 5-gallon buckets of olives. Do you press just their olives, each person's olives, one at a time?
For the people that show up with the smaller buckets, what they'll do is they'll put them together with two or three people so that they have enough fruit to produce a batch of olive oil. And then what they'll do, they split it to whatever's produced. What they're asking for here at small load day is typically anything under a ton. Two of the olive bins is a ton of fruit.
Are you doing it by varietal?
I think what they're trying to do is put the varietals together with the customers so that if it's all Arbequina, they can get all Arbequina together. Some people have a mix of fruit. Each fruit has a different flavor profile, and depending on how they put them together, the master miller determines the flavor profile of that oil being produced.
Where does all that go?
They put the fruit into the mill, then it goes through a wash station. The fruit all gets cleaned. Then from there, it goes to the crusher. It crushes the skin, the pit, the seed. At that point, it goes into the malaxer, which turns it into a mash. And there's paddles in there that works it. And what that does is it separates the oil from the paste and the mash. The pit itself actually helps to extract some of the micro oils that are caught in the skin. And then from there, it goes into the decanter. It spins the paste and gets as much of the oil out of it as it can. At that point, the paste is pumped off the mill, and then it goes through a centrifuge, which does a final cleaning and takes the moisture out of the oil and takes all the fine sediments out of it at that point. And pretty much that's the process. As far as the paste that gets produced from the byproduct of the olive oil, it can be used to feed cattle, to compost. You can till it back into the orchard, so nothing goes to waste.
Okay, and I noticed that it's kind of murky green when it comes out, but when you buy olive oil in the store, it's kind of this pale golden yellow.
As soon as they produce the oils, it's rich, it's green, it's grassy, it is a darker color, but as time progresses, it will turn a different color, that golden, that green, a lighter color, absolutely.
Rick took me on a tour of the mobile mill during the actual operation, which is very, very loud.
But it's really, really a cool operation. And this is the world's largest mobile mill. There's only two of these produced. This is a 36-foot custom trailer with a 75 kW generator, which runs the whole mill. Every farm has water, has a well, and typically that's all they need to produce olive oil. It lives here in Paso Robles, but it will be at Olea next week. Comes out on a conveyor belt. This is a vacuum that picks up any sticks, leaves, anything else that's in it. At that point, it goes into a cold water bubbler. This is cold water. It just bubbles, cleans the fruit. It goes out onto here, drops out to the screw that goes to the crusher. The oil coming out. This is a shaker fan. It gets pumped from here to the centrifuge in the back for the final cleaning. This right here is a big drum. That paste gets pushed through this. It's spinning. The paste goes off the mill through that pump. The oil drops out here. So really, really a cool operation. So this mill does 2 tons an hour, and literally from the time they put the fruit in to the time the farmer can be tasting his own olive oil. It gets produced right on site. This mill goes directly to the orchards and produces the oil as soon as it comes out of the field.
Voila, and that's how olive oil is made. Time to taste. Back at Solana with Tim.
So this is your olive oil storage.
Right. This is co pressed Arbequina olive oil with our estate navel oranges. So the oranges are ground up in the mill with the olives at the same time. So that's the only way that you can really put that molecular flavor into it. And there's no heating, there's no nothing. This is all cold. Give it a taste.
You can definitely smell the citrus, definitely.
Give it a taste. Tell me what you think.
Oh, that's really nice.
All I'm thinking is like a nice duck.
Mm, that's really nice.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, amazing. So what different flavors do you have here?
We have orange and lemon. I don't have the lemon actually here on the property. And then Korniki, Arbequina, and also a Tuscan blend. That is our own little private Tuscan blend.
That's the tasting. Then there's more.
More and more people are finding out about olive oil and the quality of the olive oil being produced here in California. And they like to come to the farm and they like to see how their olive oil is being produced. And we try and do that. We give tours here and we tell them about it and we show them the mobile mill that we have here and how olive oil is made and processed.
And Rick and Karen offer more than just tours.
This year, Olea Farm did something different, and we gave a 4-hour workshop. We talked about the history of the olives in California, how we plant the orchards, how we maintain the orchards, prune. And then we all grabbed buckets and we headed out here. Everybody picked a bucket and we took it back to the mill and we dumped it in and pressed the oil, and they left with a bottle of the oil that their hands picked, their labor of love for the day. That was received really well, and we have a lot of request to do that again next year, so we probably will. And it's great because it really brings awareness to the consumer about what it takes to produce that. You know, you walk down the aisle, you see a bottle of olive oil, you grab it, and you don't think twice about how many hands went into that. And we had a fun day. A lot of the participants said that they really didn't realize, you know, how much goes into it. We worked out here for about an hour, picking hour and a half, and everyone was pretty tuckered out. So then we went back and we had some drinks and we waited for the mill to press the oil. They were really happy with what they left because Olea Nuevo is pretty special.
It's true that most of the world's olive oil is produced in Spain and then Italy, Greece, Tunisia, and Syria to round out the top five. California production is tiny in comparison, but its quality isn't lacking. At the world's most prestigious competition, the 2019 New York International Olive Oil Competition, American olive oil producers brought home 28 gold and 27 silver awards. At least 12 of those awards went to Central Coast olive oil producers. Olive oil on the Central Coast will just continue to grow, and it will get better and better. It shows in the attitude of the growers at the Olive Oil Festival, expressed in this heartfelt summary by Karen.
We're blessed to be able to do this. It is definitely a labor of love. There's a lot of sacrifice. You know, there's a lot of sacrifice in agriculture, from the farmer to the workers. They work so hard. And it doesn't matter if it's a holiday. It doesn't matter if it's their child's fifth birthday party. They have a sacrifice. We have a sacrifice. The miller has a sacrifice, because when the fruit's ready, it's time. You know, whether they have something. All the way down to the chefs. For the chefs to use local olive oil, it obviously costs us more to produce than the big box people, the corporations. So it is a sacrifice for the chefs even to carry the local olive oil, because they have to make cuts somewhere else in order to do that. It's a beautiful thing, but it's a sacrifice for everybody to bring quality fruit and vegetables to the table.
Americans consume just under 1 liter per person per year, compared to the 12 liters for the average Greek. But consumption is on the rise, as is California olive oil production. So if you haven't tasted it yet, go out and get some. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. You can join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.